In this episode,
we look at people like Simone Biles, right? She has ADHD. And as a child, she couldn't stop moving. She couldn't stop, you know, needing to do things. And so her parents put her into gymnastics. And then she started really becoming super passionate about that thing. She started really excelling in that thing. And her parents allowed her to. She kept moving forward. And then that's what happens when we allow people with ADHD to follow their passions once they discover them.
Well, hello there. I'm Cole Gray, and this is Cole Gray in Studio A. Welcome back to the podcast. Welcome to the first episode in season 3. We're in episode 18. So we did 7 episodes in the first season, 10 episodes in the second, and we are back. And this season will take you all the way through to Thanksgiving every 2 weeks on Thursdays with fascinating conversations with interesting people on a wide variety of topics in hopes of stimulating deeper thought. Please join me. While you're at it, let's win the algorithm, shall we, today? I wish you would like and subscribe wherever you listen or watch so that you won't miss a thing. When you interact with these posts and podcasts, if you like, comment, subscribe, share, it helps me be discovered. It helps you know when I'm up to something else. So please use the links in the show notes to find and follow everywhere. Join me on social media, where I post clips from these episodes and also some other exclusive behind-the-scenes moments. I would love to have you along for the ride. Today, I have a very special guest, Shane Thrapp, who will help us understand how he navigates the world with ADHD and high-functioning autism and how he reaches out to help other people on that same journey. I learned a lot in this episode, and I think you will too. Because today's conversation goes a little long, and it needed to, I'm going to get right to the interview today, and then I'll be back on the other side with my parting thoughts. So here we go. Joining me today is Shane Thrapp. He is a certified ADHD life, relationship, and career coach through his business, Creating Order from Chaos. Shane has helped hundreds of people find their path through the chaos of life with ADHD and to find their order and their purpose. He's the operations director of a nationwide nonprofit men's ADHD support group, and he's a public speaker who advocates for adult ADHD. Shane, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm very glad you're here.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You've posted a statistic on your website that I'd like to open the conversation with, just to talk about ADHD and how widespread it is. And so according to your website, ADHD is a developmental impairment, and it's reported to negatively affect 11% of children and 5% of adults. But recent findings have reported that these numbers may actually be massively underreported, particularly in adult women and minorities. So can you speak to that just for a moment?
Yes. When we look at the statistics that CDC puts out there, they're roughly around 2.7%. And then there's also studies that have been done to show that it may be as high as 5%. However, even whenever those studies are taking into consideration socioeconomic factors and things of that nature, they don't really pay attention to the fact that so many people are misdiagnosed with other issues, not ADHD. ADHD has a high likelihood of having other comorbidities. And so when you go to talk to your psychiatrist as an adult and you go in and you tell them, I'm feeling really down all the time. I don't have any motivation to do anything. I'm tired all the time. And everything's just so overwhelming. When a typical general practitioner hears those things, he hears the criteria for depression.
That sounds like depression. Yeah.
Right. And because if we, as people with ADHD, have a hard time with memory, short-term memory, working memory, emotional regulation, prefrontal cortex, which is like where executive function centers are, and how our emotions affect our amygdala. Our amygdala is often very overreactive. We tend to show different layers of symptoms that when we go to talk to a person, because of how our memory works, we lay out the most recent things that we can identify. And that causes doctors who they will prescribe you and diagnose you with the things that they think you're explaining to them. And it's not until later on down the road when somebody like me and you have a conversation and they hear it and they start going, oh, I forgot. I also have that issue with impulsivity, or, oh man, I totally have that issue with memory. I can't remember anything. And then they start hearing people, other people talking about their lives and how they went from job to job and how they went from relationship to relationship. Or they read an article where people are describing, you know, not being able to remember to grab all the things before they needed to leave, and they get to work and they have to go back to get their work badge.
Right.
And all of these different things that for them they think is completely normal. And for a lot of people it is, every now and then. However, when we sit here and we talk about ADHD, ADHD is prevalent throughout the entire lifetime of a person, and it gets worse if it's untreated as you get older and older. And so that number is very underreported, because a lot of doctors have thought for a very long time that as a child gets older, they get better and they are able to manage their lives more effectively. However, for people of color and women who are already not able to get the treatment that they need as youngsters, people of color, mainly because they live in urban areas where there's not a lot of funding for schools to give the resources to give them the ability to do that. And the parents don't have the ability to have the time that they need with their kids, and their kids need that time very much more because of how much they have to work because of our societal issues. Won't get into that. That causes a lot of people not to get the treatment that they needed, not to get the behavioral management that they needed. And as they get older, they may find themselves in the prison system, or they may find themselves in jobs where they're just suffering and always frustrated and always stressed out. As they get older, they don't know that it's ADHD because nobody really puts any emphasis on it for them.
ADHD itself was a term I never heard until maybe 30 years ago was the first time I was exposed to that term. And I'm old enough for that to be not so long ago. I don't know if that even made sense, but I was already well into adulthood is what I'm trying to say before that phrase existed. And now also from your website, there was some information that says the advances that we've made in neuroscience and brain imaging and clinical research have shown us that ADHD is not what we thought it was originally. It's not a behavior disorder, for instance. It's not a mental illness. It's not a learning disability. It has to do with the actual structure of the brain. So it's a difference, which is where we get the phrase that's commonly used today of saying this person is not neurotypical. They're neurodiverse. So I want to give you an opportunity to address that for a minute and what that actually means, neurotypical and neurodiverse, as it pertains to ADHD.
Neurotypical are the, you know, the general majority of the population of our society. And that's kind of where the statistic, when we were talking about it earlier, that's like the 95% of people out there.
You want to say normal, but normal is such a dangerous word these days. It's almost meaningless. Yeah.
Right. You know, and so when we talk about ADHD, autism, and other like depression and other issues like that, that is a variance of neurodiversity. It's just the differences in our brains and how people develop. And then there's also a lot of genetic components to the different ways that we function within the society that we live in. There's a fascinating book by Tom Hartman called ADHD, A Hunter in a Farmer's World. And the hypothesis is that people with ADHD and even people with autism are descended from hunter-gatherer societies where that kind of mindset was very strong and very needed in those times. But then as we grew up in an agricultural society, those same skill sets that we had then don't apply to how we live in the world today.
Interesting.
And you know, it's a great book. He did a great job kind of explaining it. Now, that's a hypothesis, and there's not a whole lot of firm science behind it, like proven peer results and things of that nature. But it is a fascinating look to whenever we start looking at the differences between the people with ADHD and neurotypical people, then we start to see that, you know, we don't function as well in the society. And it's really difficult. But when we look at the science behind the ADHD brain, we know that there's differences in our brain structure and how it communicates within itself. When we look at how the dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that kind of functions within the white matter of the brain, how it communicates to the different sections of the brain, if our bodies don't produce enough of it, or our brains do not absorb it correctly or absorb it too quickly, then we see a lot of different signatures of ADHD symptom. Expressing yourself in certain ways, you're very much a daydreamer, you're very much always in your brain, you have a lot of anxieties and things of that nature, hyperactivity. We see a lot of impulsive issues where you do things without thinking about it. Emotional dysregulation is a common factor between both of them, where your emotions are just extreme at every level. Happiness, sadness, excitement, anger, rage, frustration, jealousy. Mm-hmm. All of these things are extremely like on the high end for most people with ADHD.
And so a neurotypical person is going to see that as something that requires correction or something that mm-hmm. is wrong, that needs fixing. And certainly, as you mentioned, in the culture and the society that we are currently living in and trying to thrive in, those characteristics don't lend themselves ideally to great interpersonal communications or even to functioning in the society that we have created for ourselves. But by themselves, those characteristics are not objectively wrong or bad. It sounds mm-hmm. like what we're saying here. So when we talk about neurodiverse, we're saying this person's simply wired differently and would probably thrive in a different social structure or a different cultural setting. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We see this. We've seen this in many different ways. We look at people like Simone Biles, right? She has ADHD, yes. mm-hmm. and as a child, like she couldn't stop moving. She couldn't stop being, you know, needing to do things, and so her parents put her into gymnastics, and then she started really becoming super passionate about that thing. She started really excelling in that thing, and her parents allowed her to. They kept pushing her. They kept letting her do these things, and she kept moving forward. She kept moving forward, and then that's what happens when we allow people with ADHD to follow their passions once they discover them. The problem is they're asking you 1,000 questions. Why does this work that way? Why does that work that way? Why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? Why can't I jump off this table when I'm 5 years old? Why can't I do these things? And parents are really frustrated because they have a child that's asking them 14,000 questions. What they don't understand is that child doesn't have the inherent understanding of the world around them. When we talk about ADHD and the differences in our brain, we have to look at the prefrontal cortex and the various sections of that part that make up the self-awareness. With people with ADHD, though, those communication pathways, the dopamine doesn't feed those communication pathways correctly. So we have to have an inordinately amount more understanding of the world by the people around us. A lot of our parents sat here and said, well, why can't you be like this person? Why can't you be like that person? Why can't you do this? Why aren't you able to do this? You do so amazing here, but you don't do very well here. Some of them are dealing with higher abusive issues. I grew up in an abusive childhood. My dad's favorite phrase to me was, you're the dumbest smart kid I've ever seen.
Wow.
When you have ADHD, you're 30% more likely to have lived in a traumatic environment because many of us are frustrating to parents. It's very difficult to parent us. We are more expensive than neurotypical children to raise by, you know, something like $5,000 a year.
Yeah. And the point you're raising there is that the child might be the one that is seen as having a problem, but the rest of us trying to respond appropriately to that child tend to be the ones that are behaving worse and need more direction and more correction. And I'm actually going to touch on that a little bit more in a minute, but I want to take a step back right now. We're so far down the road in this conversation, and we haven't done what's typically considered the right way to start such a conversation, which is to define ADHD. What is it that we're actually talking about? I'm assuming anybody who pressed play for this episode has either been touched by it in one way or another, or already has some familiarity with those letters, particularly that last D, which again is a big part of what we're talking about here. Like, is this really a problem that needs to be fixed? So I'm going to let you, as my expert and my guest today, describe what exactly is ADHD.
So ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder.
Disorder word. I don't like that word.
Yeah. And also, I don't like the entire phrase. The problem is, and Dr. William Dodson and Dr. Ned Halliwell are very big proponents of redefining the name of or what it means to have ADHD.
It's the thing to do these days is to relabel things, right?
Right. And Because the thing is we don't have a deficit of attention. It's not like we can't pay attention. The thing is we pay too much attention to everything around us. A neurotypical person can sit here and focus very carefully on what one thing that they're working on. When we talk about ADHD, because of how the brain communicates with our executive function and our observation skills, we can't. We are more of a shotgun blast, where neurotypical people are a laser. So the light being too bright on me, the conversation that we're having, the, you know, the letters on my screen, everything is attention to me. I'm seeing it all. And that's very difficult for us to do, because we are required by our society to be able to focus.
Yeah, on you have to filter through all of that noise to be focused on the task at hand.
Right. And we don't grow up learning that. We grow up learning that we're supposed to be able to just focus on that one thing.
Right, because you're being trained by neurotypical people. It's not a problem for them. So they're just subjecting you to the same thing that feels correct and normal. Now, what you just described, that hypersensitivity to sensory input, to me sounds like my understanding of autism. So how does ADHD either connect or not? Is it part of the spectrum? Is it an entirely separate thing? Do they intersect somewhere?
They are different things that have a lot of commonalities and can also be related. I know that didn't answer your question in any shape, form, or fashion, and I understand
It just raised six or seven more.
Right. So the thing is what we know, and we were talking about the science earlier. When we talk about ADHD and we talk about all the different issues that people face with ADHD, you know, we hear that and we're like, oh man, that also sounds very similar to autism. Right. That is because they're both developmental issues. Autism is more based in the development of our cortexes at a, you know, as a baby, as a child. And there are a lot of different genetic components to autism, and then it presents in many different ways early on. Whereas ADHD, while it has a lot of genetic components and things of that nature that we know now, has other things that can cause it to get significantly worse. And that is the difference between them mainly. Autism is autism, and it gets where it is where it is, and through therapy can get better. With ADHD, it is what it is, but then if a person has to deal with a lot of trauma or a really rough childhood or a really rough teenage years, especially through the puberty ranges, right, it can get significantly worse. But there's also a lot of commonalities. A lot of people with ADHD and autism do stimming, which is, for those who can't see me, I'm actually playing with these little magnetic rings that lets me make sure I'm focusing on the conversation. Neurotypical people don't necessarily have to do this.
So yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I'm looking at Shane, and he has some plastic rings on three of his fingers in three different colors. And I was going to say, what are those, and how does that help you do what you need to do? So we've painted the picture. Tell me.
So when we talk about stimming, what we're trying to do is we're trying to stimulate our minds. When it comes to autism, it's a habit, right? We need to be able to do something at a certain time so that we are able to do a thing that we're supposed to do, right? Mm-hmm. And it also helps with like anxieties and social anxieties. I have ADHD and high functioning autism, which is fun. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. But because I need to focus on what somebody is saying to me, I need to be able to do something that distracts me from all the things around me. And so if you notice, I actually play with it while I'm looking at the screen, and you can see it because I'm trying to pay attention to my camera and what's being said to me.
And so even though it looks like a distracting behavior, it's actually a focusing technique.
Mm-hmm. It is a focusing technique. And other people you see, they click pens. You know, they'll click pens, they'll flip them, they'll click, 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 click. That's very annoying. And when you're doing a podcast, having a clicking pen in the background is highly annoying when you're trying to edit that.
It's an editing nightmare.
Sorry. Yeah. So, you know, but, you know, when we also talk about ADHD and autism things, we also look at sensory issues, right? I have a lot of things around me, and some of them are very overstimulating. But there's also things like fluorescent lights can cause you significant migraines.
Yeah, even for the neurotypicals among us. Yeah.
Right. But you know, when we talk about ADHD and autism, they tend to be like extreme, especially for autistic kids. Like the fabric that they're wearing, the smells that they're smelling, these very overwhelming stimulations can cause us to have a lot of issues. I have a lot of texture issues with food, right? When we talk about like tomatoes and bananas and things of that nature, the texture of those things is horrifying to me. And when you have parents who try to force you to eat those things, it can cause you a significant
amount of trauma. Yeah, the challenge you're already facing then has a layer of trauma on top of it.
Right.
That makes it. And then if there's nobody there to support that or help you navigate that, then you're just in double trouble, it sounds
right.
like. And
long-term abuse of that nature, where you constantly try to force your child to eat things that they legitimately can't eat, causes things like complex PTSD.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult because, you know, for you neurotypical people out there, imagine that, you know, somebody tried to force feed you eyeballs all of your life and you knew what they were.
I'm just going to pass. I've watched some of those reality shows where people eat things that you can't. Yeah. And we watch them because we want to be grossed out, not because we want to be encouraged to do it ourselves. Oh, gosh. Right.
But when we tell our children, or as parents who were raised in the environments that we were raised in, that you need to eat this or you're going to go to bed hungry, we are 100% willing to go to bed hungry because that texture is horrifying to us.
Yeah, sure, I get that. I would.
And so, you know, and so we look at those things. And then we also look at other identifiers that are very similar between the two. Impulse control issues. You know, we react to situations that people do not understand. Like, why did you do that? And it is because we can't stop it. We have a thought, it happens. Because when you have ADHD, your brain works so quickly, right? We get on a table, we're like, ha ha ha, and then all of a sudden it says jump, we jump. Like, that's as fast as it is. And that is a part of the basal ganglia responsibility in our brain. We don't ever learn not to do that thing, you know, in a consistent manner. We're told, don't do that thing, and then some of us are spanked for it. We don't recognize that we're being spanked for doing that thing. We don't remember as children. We don't get those connections because that's part of the
social. You don't necessarily understand that the impulse response was the thing that's being addressed in that moment because it was in the stream of normal for you, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And our brains, neurotypical brains, A, B, C, D, straight line. That's how they remember things. Historically speaking, linear thinking. Neurodivergent brains, especially ADHD brains, are trigger-based memories that are all wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey, right? We don't remember yesterday. We don't remember the day before unless something triggers that memory, a smell, a taste, a touch, somebody asking us a question, somebody saying something to us that reminds us, hey, weren't you supposed to take the trash out 2 days ago? Ah, I knew I forgot something.
I have a question, Shane.
Mm-hmm.
Is wibbly wobbly timey wimey copyrighted?
I hope not. Doctor Who, please don't sue me. Thank you, BBC. That's an amazing phrase and I use it all the time.
Oh, where did you get it from? I love it.
Doctor Who, he's explaining to people about how time is all, you know, wiggly.
I just outed myself as not being a Doctor Who fan. Oh my gosh, I'm
going
to have to edit that out.
I'm judging you. Nope. You had to edit this entire conversation because I'm going to say it 14 times now.
That is awesome. To bring it back around to something almost linear, but not quite, because who cares? What is the current state of things? Are we calling it an illness? Are we calling it a disorder? Is it something that requires medical intervention? Or is it up to the rest of us neurotypicals to educate ourselves and up our game in how we interact with those of you who are neurodiverse?
When we sit here and we look at what the DSM-5 says about ADHD, it is a disorder. That's what they term it as. You know, in the DSM-4, it was considered a mental illness. You know, when we go back to like 1902, when it was really originally kind of discovered, it was a moral failing of parents towards their children, and a sign of, as children, they were damaged goods.
And so that was the DSM-1 or 0.1?
No. This is way back in the day. Yeah, it was way
back in the witch burning days.
Not quite that far back, but not too far. But the idea behind it is, we are really starting to understand it, especially with doctors like William Dodson and Dr. Ned Halliwell and the different people that are out there who are really starting to really grasp that it is just a part of neurodiversity. And, while it may be a smaller part of neurodiversity, it is still really important to understand that there are some cases where, when we are looking at it, we have to understand how we can treat it in the society that we live in, because we live in a neurotypical society, and it's not realistic for us to sit here and say, you have to just allow us to do all the things that we're going to do. That's a very difficult ask for a society who just doesn't understand it yet. But what we do need to do is start educating people on how to help us. How do we do that?
How do we recognize neurodivergence, specifically the particular flavor that is ADHD? So I'm going to say, you help me understand, what am I looking for? And if I can say, oh, I've now identified that this person is wired for ADHD, what do I do to course correct and drive a successful interpersonal encounter with this person?
So the thing is you have to educate yourself on what they are. And that's what these podcasts and other shows that are out there are about. Mm-hmm. And understanding what that means, especially if you start discovering that you've got a lot of your friends who are out there who have this constant inability to remember things. These are the friends who you invite them to go do something. They sit here and say, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. I totally will go with you. And then a day later or the day before, they sit here, oh, I'm sorry, I can't go out there. I can't go do that thing with you.
I will have an emotional response to that, thinking that this is a reflection on the solidity of our relationship, or, mm-hmm. How much this person loves me or doesn't love me. And that's not what's at work at all here, is it?
Right. It's not. Something happened where you asked them to do something. They really did want to do something with you as a friend. And a few things can happen here. Either they forgot until the day before and they've already scheduled something else in place. Whoops. Mm-hmm. Or they agreed to go do something with you, but they really didn't want to do that thing with you. They wanted to just be able to have a friend and go somewhere with you.
Right.
But they don't want to hike 5 miles. That sounds horrible once they really start thinking about it. When we sit here and we talk about ADHD and how it affects friendships, we look at, you say something to them and all of a sudden they've exploded in anger and rage at you. We actually see this a lot on the internet when we see that there's these men who wind up getting internet famous because they have a conversation with a woman on one of the dating apps that are out there. And they have this conversation, and then the girl says, hey, I really appreciate this conversation, but, I'm not really interested in dating you at this point. I'm going to go find myself somebody else. That is a reasonable thing. Hey, boundary. I'm not really interested in you in that kind of way. Or they say the dreaded, I just want to be friends.
Yeah, relegate them to the friend zone.
And so what happens in our brains, though, is we don't think about you. In this individual moment, we don't think about that. We think about the multiple different people who have rejected us over our lives. And this is where rejection.
So it's a pylon instead of an isolated incident. Mm-hmm. And so the response feels bigger, but you're actually responding to the cumulative mm-hmm. effect of multiple rejections.
Yeah. And so when we look at that, we're saying, you just reminded me of the 500 times this has happened. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take all of my frustration and rage out on you immediately right now. And because mm-hmm. of our impulsivity issues, we immediately do it. Like, we don't stop to think about it. Neurotypical people go like, wait, that's not the correct response here. Our brains, and I'm going to go real nerd in here, limbic system takes care of the emotional centers of our brain. When we observe something, somebody says something to us, it goes, hey, how am I supposed to feel about this? The hypothalamus goes back and says, okay, hey, here's a recent memory about that, but then here's all these other memories about it too. And they're all frustrating and angry and rage. And our limbic system says, oh, crap, amygdala, react. And so for men, our reactions, there's 5 different amygdala reactions that we know of now: fight, flight, fear, fawn, and fix. So for men, they wind up being 2 of them a lot: fight and fix. What can I do to fix myself to make myself somebody you would want to date? That's sometimes we see that. But the fight is the most prevalent one, especially if it's hyperactive or combined ADHD. And
because testosterone.
Right. We lash out.
Yeah.
We lash out and we become a abusive and we are enraged and things of that nature.
You know, I want to interject here and say, mm-hmm. even those of us who identify as neurotypical, even though nobody's actually told us that, we just like to assume it about ourselves. We can behave badly too. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean we have a disorder. It can be a product of unresolved past trauma. It can be ongoing current trauma. It can be poor modeling in our parents, in our family of origin. It could be any number of things. It could be something else besides ADHD, like a personality or a mood disorder. And we still, most of the time, are considered neurotypical. When it comes to interpersonal relationships, self-awareness, I think, is our greatest tool. It's more challenging, I think, for the neurodivergent or the neurodiverse person, but it's a challenge for all of us, I think. And mm-hmm. that's why I'm trying to figure out, what can we do? How do we find that place where everybody's on the same playing field? Everybody is working toward the same goal, which is to have a successful interpersonal encounter. Man, if we had the answer to that, we'd both be millionaires, wouldn't we, Shane?
I'm working really hard on this one. So I'm actually going to give you a little bit of feedback on what you just said.
Yeah, do.
Here's the difference between neurodiverse and neurotypical. Sometimes people who are neurotypical have points where they are enraged and they're frustrated and they're stressed out and they lash out at people. You know, that's a very common thing that happens mm-hmm. every now and then. However, with people with ADHD or other emotional dysregulation issues, it's very often. It is a chronic
baseline.
Right. It is mm-hmm. our normal.
Right.
Is to react extremely strongly to any kind of external input that we're getting from people about ourselves. And because of how our memory works, if we don't process the trauma, if we don't process the anger, the frustration, if we don't, let that stuff out in constructive, creative ways, it keeps building up and building up and building up. Whereas neurotypical people tend to be able to forget about it and let the things kind of go in our past and move forward and learn to move forward and process those things healthily mm-hmm. in different ways and creative ways and things of that nature. Neurotypical people don't know that. They don't know how to do that inherently. That self-awareness that you were talking about, we don't really have that. Right. The who, what, when, where, why, and how of things doesn't really mean anything to us. And so this happens to us constantly. We're constantly finding ourselves alone or not having very many friends. We've driven a lot of people off. We're annoying. It's confusing to talk to us because we randomly ramble about all of these different things that you don't really care about. And that's actually one of the things that you can really start, not you particular, but neurotypical people right. can start understanding is when you start to see these different traits with a neurodiverse person or difficulty regulating their attention and focus on a regular basis, difficulty reading social cues, right? That's a big one, right? Like yep. I have a huge problem with social cues because I have both ADHD and autism. I had to teach myself from literal, as soon as I could recognize things, I had to recognize when my dad was angry because there was issues there. I also had to then intentionally put those things in place to make sure I didn't do it. And that made me really tired all the time, because if I didn't do it, then other things would happen causing me pain. And for a very long time, I didn't get it. And so I wound up masking. And that's where a lot of people who are neurotypical don't understand what happens to us. Neurotypical people are able to mask in our society because we live in a neurotypical society. It's easier for y'all. Neurodivergent people want to fit in with what you are because that's what our society teaches us that we're supposed to be, right? We're supposed to be neurotypical. We're supposed to be normal.
And you always have this awareness, I would imagine, that you're not matching right. up to that. So yeah, it's an extra layer of difficulty. There's mm-hmm. there's the wiring as it is, and then there's the feeling of being other, and then there's the responses that you're getting from people who don't understand. It's very difficult. Yeah, so that helps. Yeah, that answers the question of what can we look for. The occasional bad behavior on the part of a neurotypical person doesn't quite align with the, this is baseline for this person, and therefore my knee-jerk response as a neurotypical person is to back off or avoid or to not come forward. But it feels to me like those people need an extra reach. We need to be healthy enough in ourselves as typical. Just because we're neurotypical doesn't mean it's easy for us either. You know, we want to run away from anything that's other. Mm-hmm. When in fact, we need to be running toward each other, I think. So can you offer any advice to someone like me when I encounter someone like you, if I'm fighting against that need, like, oh, this person, we're just not the same, you know, we just don't have any common ground here. So I'm going to turn away. If I choose not to turn away in that moment, I say, no, I'm actually going to turn toward this person. What are some things that I should bring to the table in order to increase the chances of that being a successful encounter?
The thing about us with as neurodivergents, we don't mask quite right. There's a little bit of it that just seems a little bit weird. And that is what drives that other feeling in people.
Yeah.
There's just something there. It's like this uncanny valley effect. If you've heard that with like androids, like it's just, it's too close to human. Oh my God. It's very similar.
And yet it's not.
Thing.
Yeah.
Right. And yet it's not. And that's the other feeling, right? Mm-hmm. That's what's in your lizard brain and saying, oh, something's weird.
Something's
here.
Off. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. The thing is if you show somebody who is neurodivergent that you can be trusted and that you're willing to accept who they are, the positive parts, right? We don't want to enable negative behaviors and things of that nature. But if you are willing to put the work in, you will never, ever find a more devoted friend for multiple different reasons. But the main one is like, we need somebody we can relax around.
Yeah, it's an empty spot that needs filling. So you're always going to be open to someone who's willing to fill that tank. And yeah, the whole idea of not necessarily rewarding bad behavior, that's just a boundaries thing. But to be able to separate the behavior from the person, I think is something that all of us could use a little improvement in that area. Even as parents, you know, to be able to say to your child that behavior is unacceptable, not you are unacceptable. It's the biggest difference in the world. It's like parenting 101. So yeah, any other tips?
Yeah. When we sit here and we talk about the behaviors, that's actually a really good one. Understand that behaviors are a form of communication, even with adults, right? Our rage and our anger and our frustration or our excitement, our curiosity, our fast talking, all of these things are forms of communication. Anger is, I'm really frustrated and I don't know how to express it in a cohesive manner. Having the understanding that if somebody does flash out at you, hey, please don't act that way. I'm going to give you a few minutes to let you figure out what's going on there. When you're ready to have a discussion about this, let's talk about it and see what's going on. Like, what happened there? Mm-hmm. Right? We're not rewarding behavior. We're setting a boundary.
Yeah.
We're walking away and giving them the space that they need to calm down. And then we're showing them that we're willing to communicate about it, you know, whenever they're ready to have the communication.
And it's a funny thing. I think in my observation, we're really willing to do that when as adults, we're interacting with children, but when we're interacting adult to adult, we throw that right out the window, don't we? We just react. It's like, you ought to know better, you know, and sometimes we don't.
Yeah. And sometimes we can't. We never learned, right? And because ADHD is a developmental issue, as we get older, we actually develop slower. We're not stupid. We're not dumb. We're not any of those things. We just develop at a different rate than other people. Mm-hmm. As we get older, if people show us the who, what, when, where, why, and how of our behaviors and we should be acting, but in how to do it in a healthy way, we don't have to wear the mask as often. And we are able to be more of ourselves and our authentic who we are and then, you know, present that person to the people around us and we will eventually find our tribe. But if people don't show us those things, we just kind of wander through life aimlessly and we don't know.
Feeling like a misfit. Yeah.
Right. We feel like a misfit. We don't fit in with anybody because nobody really takes the time to get to know us. Yeah. And so we stop caring about ourselves, which then drives more people away from us. Mm-hmm. And we wind up being alone. And the more alone that we are, the more detrimental it is on our physical and mental health. And then we get worse and worse. And that's where that cycle of things. So when we talk about how do we want to treat people who have ADHD or autism, just accept who they are, not the negative behaviors, you know, work through trying to understand what they're trying to say, what they're trying to communicate in those fashions, but keep moving forward with it and keep trying to see where things can go. And if they're really passionate about something and you don't really care about that, you know, give them the freedom to be able to go ahead and talk about it, you know, because it's very hard for them to talk to you about the things that you're really passionate about because they don't care.
Yeah.
Because it's not important to us because we are very much in our own brain.
And that whole layer of social grace where you politely ask people to tell you about them is not necessarily intuitive for you. It's something that I learned. That's how you have a conversation when you're meeting somebody, is you engage them. You don't just start talking about yourself. You ask them about themselves. And tell me if I'm on the mark here. In people that I've encountered that I have assessed might be struggling with ADHD or even autism, or, you know, any other, if I get that sense of other, I have found that I get a response of appreciation when I establish boundaries in a way that I would not with any other person. So if I just make it really, really clear, and it's the kind of thing where you're like, oh gosh, I don't want to say this thing to this person because I don't want to hurt their feelings or they might get offended. But I've found with people who are wired in this particular way, to lay it out clearly and say, I don't like it when this happens, or I need more of this. And just to, in a direct way that doesn't necessarily work in a neurotypical interaction, is something that can really be breakthrough inducing in a relationship like that. So in that case, I'm the person that has to make the adjustment, not necessarily the person who's neurodiverse.
Right. So talk to us like we're kids in a mature manner.
Yes, without being condescending or insulting, right. But very direct in a way that might be uncomfortable for another neurotypical person.
Right. We need that structure. People with ADHD absolutely need structure. People with autism crave structure. It needs to be very familiar and routine. And so when you tell us a certain way or a certain boundary or a certain rule that, you know, you would like us to follow, we will do our best and we will try to make sure that we're going within that.
Because you know the rules. Within reason. Yeah.
Right. I know the rules. I know what my boundaries are. So if you say, hey, I'm not really interested in that, can we talk about other things? And we can sit here, okay, no problem. I've got 14,000 things that you that we can talk about. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah.
But other things are like, do you actually want to go for a hike with me, or do you just want to spend time together? That sounds really awkward because you just asked them to go hiking. They said, sure, of course I would love to. Right. But when you actually drill down into it and give them a second to think about it, they go, actually, no, not really. Can we just hang out sometime, watch a movie? I don't know if I'd be willing to go hiking. Give them the opportunity to really think about it for a second after you ask and they say yes. You know, just want to make a double check with you. Are you sure you want to go hiking? Or checking in with them a few days later. Hey, did you put that in your calendar like we talked about? You know, just want to make sure that we're on the same page. I want to make sure that we go have fun with this. You know, just kind of giving them reminders and giving them the ability to like think about things and process things before you really put in place ironclad, this person will be here. Give them the ability to kind of get their heads wrapped around the thing that you want to go do.
And I would add to that, if it doesn't go the way you expect it to not hold everyone to your specific standard of what is normal or acceptable. I know that for me, that is a lesson that I had to learn, where I had to really take it on a case-by-case basis and not evaluate every individual person against what I think is acceptable or ideal, and just say, well, this didn't go the way I expected. Let me spend a minute, you know, let me just take a beat and say, why did it go this way? What do I know about this person? Especially if it's a behavior that repeats, you can go, okay, this is not about rudeness, or this is not about irresponsibility. This is about wiring, and I need to meet that person where they are if I care to be in an ongoing relationship with them. It's not all one person's responsibility. It's a cooperative effort, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. So when we talk about relationships, another thing that we need to talk about is the brain of ADHD and the WIN. You'll have a conversation with us, and this is one of the biggest indicators that a person probably has ADHD. You'll have a conversation with us on Friday. 2 months later, we'll pick up the conversation almost word for word from where we left it off at.
Wow.
And it seems like absolutely no time has passed at all for us, because it hasn't. We were talking about that thing then. We look at our phone. Oh, crap. I haven't messaged that person in 2 months. Ooh. Right? Okay. Well, I'll just start the conversation. Or another thing that happens is we'll talk to you on Friday. The next Friday, we'll go, oh, man, I haven't said anything to them in a week. I don't want to. I'll be a bad friend if I just message them now. And then we'll just like, we can avoid that. 2 weeks later, we do the same thing. 2 weeks later, we do the same thing. And then finally, we're just like, fuck it. I'm gonna message them, but I'll just talk about the thing and I'll just leave it like it is. That's a part of us. So if you really want to develop a friendship with them and you want them to be able to learn to take the mask off and things like that, you may have to be the one who's reaching out to them more often than they reach out to you. Because of how our memory works, time works differently for us. So what was 2 months for you was 2 weeks for us. And that's just a thing that we have to be aware of as neurodivergent versus neurotypical people.
It's fascinating. So you've been really brave and really forthcoming during this entire conversation about your own struggles. You've mentioned that you have ADHD as well as autism. I want to give you an opportunity to share a little bit about your own personal story and how you got from where you were to actually reaching out and helping other people. But let's just take your personal story first. What would you like to share about your journey?
So I was raised in Northeast Texas in a very rural environment. I was like 75 miles to the nearest Walmart, if that gives you any indicator how far out in the boonies I was. And my dad was an alcoholic, abusive person, and it was really frustrating and stressful living around him. When I say abusive, it was physically, mentally, emotionally abusive towards me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, emotionally and mentally abusive towards my mom. I actually grew up in a very religious area. The church that we went to was later on deemed to be a cult.
Oh, dear.
It was a Southern Pentecostal church. I had my first exorcism when I was 11 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was because the preacher was going on about Noah's Ark, and he was at screaming to the microphone, and he was describing not Noah bringing all the animals and putting them in the ark and everything like that. He was talking about the people who were drowning outside of it and how they were raising their babies up to Noah to try to get him to save them. And I asked my grandmother, I said, why is God such an asshole?
Oh, gosh.
And I did it in true child with ADHD fashion at the exact wrong moment. Because he had done that thing where a preacher sits here and he says this amazing part of it where it's very emphatic, and he stops to give a pause so that the church gets to say hallelujah, amen, right, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I caught that exact moment before, from when he stopped to when people would have normally reacted. And I happened to say that at that exact point, and he heard me.
Oh, dear.
And so he came stomping down the church aisle, and he grabbed me by my arm, and he yanked me up to the front of the church, and he called all the senior elders of the church to the front.
In the middle of the service.
Right, in the middle of the service. Holy grabbed cow. Holy water and holy oil, and then spent an hour trying to cast the demon of hell out of me.
How were you feeling in that moment?
Just absolutely, completely, and utterly blown out of my mind.
Did you believe at that moment that you needed an exorcism?
I mean, yeah, I had been raised in this environment all my life. I just assumed that I had something going on with me. I didn't know.
Were you already having that feeling of being other?
Yeah.
And so you figured this must be it. It must be the demon in me.
Right. And I was scared straight for a while, right? Yeah. My dad, though, lost his ever-loving mind. He wasn't a religious person at the time. Wow. He only became religious whenever my mom would leave him. You know, he told me I wasn't allowed to tell my mom, but he threatened a preacher's life. He said, and the irony of this factor is the fact that my dad was so abusive and so just damaging to me, but also my dad's probably saved my life 4 or 5 times. I've been snake bit 3 times. We faced down a black bear in the woods. There's multiple points where I was stranded out in the wilderness and my dad came and found me and things like that. But at the same time, he would just do some of the most horrible things to me, right? Wake me up with
how
an extension
confusing
cord.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And when you have autism, you crave structure and order. My dad was chaos personified. And so I struggled through school with social interactions, but I excelled in school through all the other things that I needed to do. I had a college level reading level at seventh grade.
Yeah, not uncommon for people on the spectrum.
My reading speed is astronomical, but I was horrible at math. So I started phoning in school. Like, I just didn't care about it. It didn't mean anything to me. I didn't have any social circles that were meant anything. But so that turned into a drug habit, by the way, you know.
Oh dear.
Introduced to marijuana. That was my thing. And so I hung out with the potheads. Yeah, and that's what we did. I had a car and I was like essentially the taxi of the people around me.
By the way, I just want to interject a personal opinion that I don't consider marijuana use a drug habit.
No. I 100% I get it. You know, an addiction is when it controls your life and you can't get away from it. So when I talk about addiction, I very much mean
you were relying on that in order to cope with your world.
Yeah. Right. And,
were you still a part of the church during this time, or had you separated from them then?
I had separated from them because my gram had enough of his shit. And she went up and she goes, I have a testimony to talk about. And she went on a good 3-minute rant about how this church had gone away from the teachings of Christ and that.
In the church she did this?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And grandma.
You're right. And he went to kind of walk towards her, and she goes, if you touch me, I'll shoot you. And everybody knew my gram carried a .38 revolver with her.
I love this woman.
I loved her, too. She was amazing. And so she actually wound up taking like half the congregation and forming her own church.
She didn't.
Mm-hmm. And so I had left that church. I had kind of followed her church, but it wasn't my thing, right? I had that trauma issue, right? Yep. And I had a new habit that I really wanted to do, and I didn't want anybody to tell me I couldn't do it. Then I graduated from high school, and I graduated with like a 3.75 GPA. So that was me phoning it in, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I still graduated like 8th in my class. Then I lost all that structure of school. And my dad didn't want to help me with anything because he had just divorced, or my mom had just divorced him, and he was going through his own world of destruction. And my mom didn't want to help me because she was free. She didn't want a memory of all the stuff that she had gone through. And sure. I was 18 years old and I was supposed to be able to be a man and go off on my own. And I had a drug habit at this point. And now it wasn't marijuana. It was opioids. And it was Oxycontin and hydrocodone from an injury I'd had when I was 17.
Wow.
I lost a bunch of scholarships because I blew my back out when I was 17. I had to have surgery. And so
that's where you were introduced to those substances. Do you think that one or both of your parents also struggled with ADHD and or autism?
I look back at my dad's behaviors and I'm fairly certain he had ADHD.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Isn't that statistically common that in a child that one or both parents will also have ADHD?
Yes. If there's one parent that has ADHD, it's 40 to 60% likely that one of the children in the household is going to. Mm-hmm. If both parents have it, obviously it goes up because, you know, genetics.
Of course.
But it's about 80% or so that one or more of the children in the household are going to have ADHD. So I'm fairly certain my dad did. My mom actually shows a lot of different behaviors that I think are on the spectrum. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, so I don't diagnose people.
Yeah.
But I just see a lot of like my issues there.
So you were in this period of your life where you no longer had an imposed structure. You're now free to do as you will, and you have no idea what to do with that. For how long did that go on?
I didn't have anybody. My friend network had kind of scattered because of college and life and things of that nature. So I essentially became homeless, right? I lived in trailers that didn't have power. I lived in my car if I needed to. I would couch hop and couch hop, and that happened for 4 years. Then I met a woman I would actually wind up marrying, and I tried to become everything that she wanted me to become. And this is the thing with ADHD. If we know, if we see your dating profile, or if you tell us what you want from us to be, how you want us to be, and how you want that perfect date,
you'll
to
morph into that. Yeah.
We like, oh, here's my mask. Boop. I am your perfect date. And for 6 to 8 months, we're that thing that you really wanted us to be. And then all of a sudden we take the mask off because now we're comfortable and we think we can trust you. And we're not the same person that you cared about. After we had had a child and we had moved to Maryland, she didn't like who I was. I was a person who had ADHD. I didn't have an easy time keeping jobs. It was very difficult for me to work one job for any length of time before I would drive everybody around me nuts with my just being overbearing and asking a lot of questions and wanting things to be done a certain way and having all these different ideas of what I thought would be a more efficient way of doing things and how to build structure and how to build order and things. And eventually I wound up actually impressing a warehouse manager who was trying to find his replacement, and I got into management. Now I get to tell people what to do. Things got a little bit better. We wound up having another kid, but then, you know, I lost that job, and now I'm not able to be a good provider again. Everything started going downhill. And then, you know, everything imploded, and we got a divorce.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2006, 7, 2008.
And I'm hoping that this is the part where awakening happens and things start to take an upward trajectory.
After about a year of being homeless, yes.
Oh, gosh.
When I was 28, I decided, I said, you know, I'm done with this. I don't know what's going on with me. I know I'm weird. I know I'm different. And I'm just going to own that stuff. I said, I'm going to stop. I didn't know I was masking. I didn't understand that concept at that point. And then, you know, so I just said, screw it. And so I put it in my dating profile. I'm just who I am. This is me. You know, hope y'all enjoy it. Let's go on a date. Let's have fun. And I just started dating. And then I found this woman who met almost all my criteria. Red hair, beautiful, amazing. She's a special needs teacher. And she seemed to just get me. And as she got me, it was there. Everything was there. And she just kept getting me, and I never had to wear a mask with her. I never felt the need to wear a mask with her. And then, you know, as we were kind of moving along, I get a call from my oldest son's school, and the teacher tells me, hey, we think your son has ADHD. I didn't know what this is. I had no clue. All I thought about was ADHD was that little badass white kid in the corner who was just being a terror. And I was like, my son doesn't have ADHD. What are you talking about? But then as I studied it, I started seeing all the similarities and all the things. And I said, oh, no. And so I go to my wife and I sit here and say, hey, I think I have ADHD. And she goes, oh, honey, you didn't know? And I'm like, no, I didn't know. Wow. How long have you known? And she's like, I've known since I read your dating profile. And I'm like, why didn't you say something? She goes, I just thought you were being a dude and not, you know, thought you were being okay with it. But that was it. That was the start of my journey into discovering ADHD. ADHD became this huge hyperfocus for me. And I started going through that path. I started learning everything I could about it. The thing is whenever I went to go get diagnosed with it, I actually had to go to three different psychiatrists before I'd get one to actually diagnose me. First one tried to diagnose me with major depressive disorder because I went in there and I told her, hey, I have no motivation. I can't do anything. I don't want to do anything. I can't do these things. And I'm sad all the time because I don't have any friends. Right?
So boom. Sounds familiar. Yeah, depression.
So she gives me medication, SSRIs. I started winding up having manic episodes. So I go to the next doctor and I say, hey, I'm having all these different issues. I'm sad all the time sometimes, but then every now and then I have these manic episodes.
Oh, boom, bipolar.
Bam, there you go. Yeah. But the more I studied ADHD, the more I started understanding that ADHD is often the basis for comorbidities that are included throughout a life of trauma or a life of difficulty and things of that nature.
Right.
And so when we look at ADHD, we see comorbidities such as autism, by the way, 40% likelihood of having autism. But then there's also depression, PTSD, and other things like that. We're four times more likely to develop PTSD because we develop trauma easier than other people. That's the thing we deal with. And so I finally went to another psychiatrist and I said, hey, I think I have ADHD. I would please test me for ADHD, just even if it's to rule it out. And she said, no problem. And she pulls out a little document and she starts asking me the little questionnaire for ADHD. About halfway through, about three quarters of the way through it, she also then goes, hold on a second. And she pulls out another sheet of paper, puts it under it, and she finishes up that. And then she asked me another series of questions. She goes, I don't just think you have autism. I think, or ADHD. I think you also have autism. And I'm like, get the fuck out of here. No, I don't. But that was at the point, you know, she goes, we're going to get you tested fully. And so she sends me to a specialist. They do the full gamut of testing. And it turns out I have ADHD, inattentive, mostly combined.
What is the full gamut of testing? Is that imaging and other kinds of evaluative tools, or is it all just questionnaires and assessments?
No, for some reason, scientists feel like, or doctors feel like, the best way to test ADHD to people is to give them a whole bunch of tests that they have to complete in a certain amount of time, and then turn it in, and then expect that to get done in a certain amount of time as well. But they also test the people around you, your family members. They also ask about your childhood, what kind of things you dealt with there, academically speaking, socially speaking, and a few other different things.
And then all of those assessments have scores, I would imagine.
Right. And then, like, you wind up getting, you know, a final diagnosis. And now I have the diagnosis. I'm dealing with relief because I'm actually not this damaged goods thing. I'm not the trauma of my past. I don't have to own that stuff. And I'm able to start getting treatment for it. And then I start to watch a lot of my different issues, such as depression, really start to slide away. My ability to focus got a lot better. And then in 2016, I had a nervous breakdown.
Oh, dear. I'm so sorry.
And then 2019, beginning of 2019, I found out we were having twins.
Oh.
And my wife has always been supportive of me. And at that point, she goes, hey, you get to be a stay-at-home dad. Mixed blessings, but you get to be a stay-at-home dad. We'll just make sure our finances can, you know, take care of this. And we did. We put everything in place that we needed to live on her wages. But I still needed some purpose. And then through, ironically enough, a life coach, I discovered ADHD life coaching. And that was my thing. That became my thing. I want to help people with ADHD who have gone through the mess and struggle and things that I've gone through in my life and who are going through the mess and struggle and things of their life. I wanted to create order from their chaos. I did it for businesses. Now I wanted to do it for people. I wanted to give back all of this information that I have. I want to give back all of the lessons that I've learned, all the things that I've learned through science and through working with therapists and psychiatrists and working with different organizations to discover and understand more about ADHD and autism and how to function within the society that we do, while at the same time advocating for ourselves to say, I am not broken. I am a person and I deserve respect. And I'm working to be a better person. I want to be able to give the people the ability to do that.
I have a personal history, a long journey with loss and grief in my life. My husband and I have both been through what seems like an extraordinary number of losses between us. And in my personal search for how to make sense of that, how to find purpose in that, and not to just feel like I got dealt a bad hand, I very much wanted to be able to reach out and assist other people with their grief journeys. And when I started looking into how to do that, one of the first things I learned was, especially in grief recovery, how important it is for anyone in a facilitator's role not to try to help anybody else until you can be assured that you have sufficiently healed from your own grief. And otherwise, you can actually make it worse for other people. And so I did that. I was actually a facilitator for a grief recovery ministry at the church I was attending at the time. I did that for 3 years. I absolutely felt that I had found my niche. This is what I was supposed to be doing. It made everything make sense. And then I went through another bout of multiple losses, where I immediately knew that the only correct thing to do in that moment was to step back and not be in that leadership role. My most recent loss was less than 6 months ago, so I kind of can't catch enough of a break to get back to a point where I feel sufficiently recovered in order to begin thinking that I can help anybody else. Do you think that that applies here as well, or is it not necessarily such a requirement? The desire to help other people out of, you know, to share with them what you've learned and what has worked from you, but you're still very much living with this on a day-to-day basis. It's not like you have an experience and then you recover from it. This is something that you live with day to day. Do you think there's any level of success in your treatment journey that you needed to complete before you were ready to then reach out and help others?
Yeah, because so many people with ADHD and autism have so much trauma, I have to be very aware of that. And that's actually why I became a coach instead of a therapist.
Right.
And there's a very, very firm line between a coach, a therapist, and a counselor. And as a coach, I really make sure that if there is a lot of strong emotional issues or trauma-based issues, that I'm referring these people to make sure that they are getting psychiatric help, that they are getting the therapy help.
And then come get some coaching, sure.
Yeah. And so my work is very much very structured as professional project management for humans. And that is kind of developing them. And so who I work with are primarily people who have actually already gone through psychiatry and a little bit of therapy and have hit a point where they're ready to start
next level.
You know, they're ready to start the next level of putting in place the structure that they need as a person with ADHD.
So you do that through your business is creatingorderfromchaos.com. There will be links in the show notes where people can find you there. Is that something that you offer locally, virtually? How do you work with people?
I do mostly virtual. And, you know, that's mainly because of the other business venture that I'm in right now. And, you know, and I just really enjoy it. I really enjoy helping people like that.
Yeah, let's talk about that other venture. You are the operations director of, I believe you mentioned to me before we pressed record, a brand new nonprofit, which has already been functioning as a nationwide men's ADHD support group on Facebook. And y'all just decided to go official with it as far as a nonprofit goes. Congratulations. And operations director is a pretty impressive title. So, you know, mad respect and all of that. That is specifically for men with ADHD. Why?
When you go on Facebook and you put in ADHD support, you'll see 80 different pages and groups for women who are dealing with, you know, ADHD, or women and men, like co-ed groups. You'll see all those groups. However, when you go in there and you look at, like, specifically men ADHD groups, there's very few. And the ones that are there, they're not very active, or the ones that are there when you go to them are full of horrifyingly toxic environments, right? It's a lot of men who are talking about all the things that women have done to them that are pretty, like, horrific. It's a very negative environment. There's a lot of toxic masculinity, of men not really caring that you have other mental health issues. You need to just do it. And they give a lot of tough love. There's air quotes there for y'all. And
so it sounds like that's more like a peer group and not any kind of curated or managed support.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when the creator a few years ago, when the creator Mark Almodovar wanted to create this group, he wanted to build this environment, he wanted a place where we could really put in place a lot of things that would be healthy, right? But also then put in place boundaries on how to communicate with each other effectively, how to not be bullies. And he wanted people to be uplifting each other and listening and showing empathy. And then he started teaching people what that looked like. Right. We have biweekly group support calls where we talk about the different things with ADHD. And a lot of it's just always showing each other love and support and lifting ourselves up, you know, and keep moving through that entire in the conversations that we have. And we also want to educate people on what ADHD actually means, because a lot of men come in here and they have the mindset that having a mental health issue means that you're broken. And then if there's depression or bipolar or borderline personality or other issues that you're facing, let's help you get the resources that you need to get the treatment that you need to get the support that you need. And so he created that, and then he brought me on board last year, and he doesn't allow any kind of spam. He doesn't allow other coaches to promote their business. He doesn't even promote his own business that he does. He doesn't allow people to come in with any like real toxic positivity. And for people who don't know what that is, that's when you are super positive about a thing that's got a lot of disabilities assigned to it as well, ignoring the disabilities that are inherent there. And so we just really strongly encourage people to communicate. Right. We really strongly encourage people to have a positive attitude as much as we can. But we show them what that means by accepting who they are and working on the problems that they face through group coaching.
How long has the Facebook group existed?
3-4 years now.
And what kind of following do you have there right now?
Right now, we have about 13,000 members. But
that's impressive.
It is. Yes. But what is really impressive is our interaction. Every day we have close to about 8,000 or 5,000 to 8,000 interactions on our page. That means any given day there's 8,000 likes, clicks, comments, posts.
And is all that of those just things. In the Facebook group alone?
Mm-hmm. Just in a Facebook group alone.
And what are you going to do with it now that you're forming a nonprofit? How do we take this to the next level?
So the next level is now working with other organizations to really start doing public speaking more.
Advocacy.
Right. Advocacy, getting into the really meat and bones of really starting to develop this message and get people out there, get people in the group. We're never going to charge people for the group. Other coaches are out there. They're charging $20 a person to get in their groups. And we refuse to do that.
Sure.
In fact, we're never going to change the rule about spam in our group. We're not going to allow it. We will sit here and say, hey, if you want to donate, feel free to donate. Here's how you do that. But all of that money is going back into the organization. Yeah. It's all going to go back to working with different public speakers, but also going back into the communities so that we can develop these in-person events and in-person chapters who are then able to do in-person get-togethers and really start to have a community of people with ADHD who are able to start finding their tribes and start processing through what they are without having that negative stigma around ADHD and mental health. You know, our whole purpose is to change the narrative about what it means to be a man who has ADHD and how important mental health is. And so by changing that narrative with men, because we live in a patriarchal society, we want to see that change start moving into our governance. And we also want to see that change happening so that we can see children being raised in environments where there's a lot of positive parenting. The father understands the importance of mental health and also understands the importance of his mental health so that he's learning to be a positive role model and understanding how to learn how to communicate with their children who are hard to parent due to having ADHD or autism or other special needs.
That is wonderful, wonderful work. Does it dovetail with what you're doing in creating order from chaos, or do you see that being the next step for you? Are you going to continue to do both, or do you see yourself switching over to the nonprofit going forward?
I have ADHD, so it's probably going to be both. my coaching business is very much one-on-one.
And is that also targeted at men, or do you work with everybody?
I work with Children. Everybody as far as my own personal business is concerned. I help with parents. My wife is a special needs teacher. If I do have a parent who has a lot of questions about how to help their child with special needs or ADHD or autism or things of that nature, my wife will help me kind of like mediate through that conversation. But primarily, my goal is to teach the parent how to give their child a positive parenting experience.
So your personal coaching business is creatingorderfromchaos.com. And the group on Facebook is called Men's ADHD Support Group. And those links are going to be in the show notes. So you can check those out if you're interested in learning more about those things, or if you want to join or get in touch with Shane for personal coaching. You are doing your part, sir. And it's been an honor to have you on the podcast today. I hope I didn't freak you out too much.
You mentioned before the
podcast could be stressful.
Yeah, you were amazing. I always thought I was an ambivert. It turns out that I'm an introvert who's good at masking. Learning that, though, I've actually learned that it's easier for me to public speak now and to actually go out in public and do these things because I have the coping mechanisms.
Yeah, your authenticity is on display, and it's a beautiful thing to behold. I'm really grateful for this conversation. I learned some things. Thank you so much. I think you've added a lot of value to the podcast, and I hope every listener today got something out of it.
I'm so glad that Shane was able to join me. I really did get so much out of this conversation. Whether or not your life is currently touched by someone with ADHD or autism, you do interact with people on a regular basis. So I really do think that there were little nuggets of wisdom and wonderfulness in this conversation that will help us in our day-to-day efforts to connect with each other. I hope you felt the same way. You can let me know. I always welcome your feedback. My parting thought today, when I found it on social media, it was attributed to Nikola Tesla. I don't know if that's true. We never do know. I'm pretty sure Abraham Lincoln said everything, or Albert Einstein, but this was credited to him, and I just wanted to share it with you today. The quote goes like this: when you understand every opinion is a vision loaded with personal history, you'll start to understand that all judgment is a confession. Spend a few minutes thinking about that, would you? I'll be back with you in 2 weeks with another interesting conversation with another interesting person. In the meantime, I want to say thanks for listening. Come on back, and I will see you next time. Cool Gray and Studio A is a fine-tuned services production. It exists for entertainment purposes and is not intended to be used as a sole source of information or advice on any subject. Find and follow this podcast at coolgraystudios.com.